guys. Welcome to another episode of Political Roots. I'm your host, Michael Starr Hopkins, and I have a really special guest for you guys today. We've got Christina Sinsoon Ramirez. Did I do this right?
You did it 100% right. So good.
Christina is the executive director of NextGen America, the nation's largest youth voting rights organization. NextGen has registered and mobilized millions of young people to the polls with the goal of harnessing the power of young people to reshape the political outcome of our country, not for an election cycle, but for a generation. Christina, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm very good. Very good.
I've been talking a lot about the youth vote and how important it is to get the youth vote. Just talk to me for a second kind of about the landscape of politics right now and what we're seeing.
Yeah, so I think what we're, you know, like I think historically, because I work with young people, right? This is right now, young people now represent the largest, most diverse and progressive generation in American history. And what's really fascinating is like the myths that young people are really busting about their political power. So, you know, a lot of people think young people are apathetic, right? That they don't vote, that they don't care. But this is the generation that's voting at the highest levels in American history. So you see really high voter participation and also really strong political education. So young people through social media, being able to learn about different trends and movements and being really politically and socially aware, being really socially conscious as well about climate change, racial justice, economic inequality. And then the other thing about the youth vote, I'm not going to guess your age, Michael, but like I'm an older millennial. And so
I'm 37. I'm proud of it.
Yeah, we're in the same generation, but like the other myth is that as young people get older, they always get more conservative. So like, don't worry, they're going to realize they're Republicans later. And
that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and both in the United States and in Western Europe, what's actually happening is that millennials are staying just as progressive as they were when they are young. And so we're in this big moment of political disruption with young people. And then the other thing I would say about young people that I think is fascinating is while they vote overwhelmingly for Democrats, really they see themselves as independents. What they care about is progressive policy change. And we are in a moment when, yes, fascism is on the rise and the ultra-right can feel ascendant, but actually what I think is ascendant is the political power of young progressives, because you and I can remember the Democratic Party of the 90s that was on the wrong side of criminal justice reform, was on the wrong side of taxing the rich, was often on the wrong side of the labor movement and gay marriage. And now we've come to a place where even the Biden administration and people that saw themselves as more moderates are talking about taxing the rich, people deserving their fair share, racial justice lens integrated into all the policy decisions that they're making. And I attribute that to the power of young people. I never believe elected officials do stuff on their own. I believe they do it because voters organize and mobilize and push them in the right direction.
Yeah, politicians are always short on political courage. It's interesting you talk about the 90s and Bill Clinton, don't ask, don't tell, the war on crime. You know, Democrats have historically relied on voters of color to carry them across the finish line, but haven't always been as supportive of those very voters. One of the things I've really been talking a lot about over the last couple of months is African-American voters, voters of color, and how vital they are to Democrats securing not just the White House in 2024, but down ticket. Talk to me about what Democrats need to do in terms of voters of color to really make sure that we're putting forward not just progressive platforms, because especially in the African-American community, a lot of African-Americans don't actually see themselves as progressive. We are a more conservative voting bloc, not to say that we're monolithic. I feel like you always have to add that in there.
In the Latino community, and I think in all communities, right? Like, I think people expect that Black and brown voters all share the same ideals on everything. And we don't expect that of white folks. And I don't think we should expect that of Black and brown folks.
Absolutely. And I think that gets to my point. Like, how do Democrats turn out these communities who are so different within the community, within the Latino community, within the African-American community? You have such diverse subsets that not just you want to appeal to because these are people, but that you want to turn out and get enthusiastic.
Yeah, so I think there's really three ways that we want to see the Democratic Party and candidates investing in our community. So one is by putting money where their mouth is and investing and reaching out to our communities. You know, you'll often, once you survey communities of color, now it's better for the African-American vote, but not as good for the Latino vote and the youth vote. Well, youth vote includes Black and Brown folks because also younger people are more diverse, right? But you'll get a huge share of Latinos and young people and African-Americans saying, well, no one reached out to me this election, so I didn't know who to vote for. So if they're not spending the time and money on reaching out to us and telling us their policy positions and how they're going to make our lives better, we're not going to vote for them. So they need to spend the money and time talking and connecting to our community. The second thing they need to do, and I think we have seen real movement and traction with this, is when we take power, is we actually have to make the rules of the game benefit voters, right? And it doesn't have to just benefit Black and Brown voters, but you see in places like Michigan, Pennsylvania now, other states that are now making automatic voter registration, mm-hmm. right? And that's just already expanding the electorate. Like, why should I have to register to vote if I'm an American citizen? I should just be able to vote. That should be part of the process. I live in Texas, where we make it, it's actually designated by the Brennan Center as the hardest place to register to
vote. I was just going to say, we're going to get into Texas.
Yeah. And that's not by coincidence. That's by design. So if they've designed a system to keep us from being able to access the ballot box and put up barriers, when we gain power, we need to make sure we're taking down those barriers. And I think that there's been some creative work on that, but we still have to keep doing that. And then I think the third thing is running candidates that look like us, that speak to our pain and our power in our communities. And that's, I think, where we see some investment. But again, those candidates have to speak to our pain in our communities and our power. It's not enough for me that a candidate share my same surname or come from my same ethnic background. Like, ultimately, that lived experience needs to translate into public policy that changes our reality. Or else, you know, I could be a Marco Rubio fan or a Ted Cruz fan. You know
what? Yeah, I say all the time, all skin folk ain't kin folk. Ask Tim Scott about that.
Yeah.
So the Latino community, obviously, right now, immigration is a big topic being discussed right now, a topic which doesn't affect just the Latino community. But I've spent a lot of time in Florida, and immigration in Texas and Florida have been very hotbed conversations. And so first, I want to ask, how did Democrats better talk to the Latino community? Because in Florida, historically, Democrats have just been horrific in their outreach, whether it be to Latino Americans, whether it be to Central America. I mean, just it's been horrible in the messaging.
Yeah, so I think when we talk about Latinos immigration in our country, the answers are both simple and complex, right? And so I think the first thing to understand about Latinos is that we are a very, very broad category, right? So you can be Afro-Latino, you can be a white Latino. It's not actually a race. It is an ethnic group that shares like a common language and history and tie to Latin America. But then the funny part is, you know, if you're like me in Texas, we live at this very strange duality as a community where, yes, many of us are newly arrived to this country. And at the same time, if you live in Texas or California or Arizona, New Mexico, we've existed in these lands before the United States was even a construct or an idea, right?
Absolutely.
So for me, I think it's really important to understand and recognize that first. And then when we talk about immigration to this country, and then I'll talk a little bit about Latinos, the difference between Latinos in Florida, Texas,
absolutely,
Mexico, et cetera, is, you know, no country, hands down, has benefited more from immigration than this one because it was created out of pain.
Legal or illegal immigration.
Right. Forced migration or by choice, right? And we were fine with allowing people to come to this country and expand and grow when it was white folks, right? And
Westward expansion.
Yeah. I spent, I don't know if you know this, Michael, actually my first job ever was I spent 10 years organizing construction workers in Texas. And it's the largest employer of undocumented labor across the state. So it also happens to be one of the largest contributors to the Republican Party, some of the most abysmal working conditions in the entire country. So half of the workforce of the million workers are undocumented in the state. Every 2.5 days, a construction worker is killed on the job in Texas, higher than any other state in the country, even if their workforces are much larger than ours, like in the state of California. And even though, again, construction industry is one of the largest contributors to the Republican Party, you would think that there would be a vested interest in fighting for immigration reform, because they say they want to protect Republicans. They're really interested in protecting American
the status quo. Yeah,
but they don't actually have a vested interest in changing it. What they want is a cheap labor force that is easily exploitable. And so if workers are undocumented, it does hurt American workers and it hurts undocumented workers. Like, I think we have to acknowledge that it does both. But again, the people that benefit that are not the undocumented workers. It is the huge big corporations and ultimately consumers that get something at a cheaper cost when we don't put in the social cost, the human cost into it. So I think when we look at immigration, Republicans have a vested interest because of business interests to keep it at the status quo. And lastly, because they need a boogeyman, because they don't real have real policies. And so the boogeyman becomes poor brown and black immigrants that are coming from the South, the unknown, into the country, and are criminals, rapists. And, you know, we've heard this scenario, whether you talk about, you can look at these same narratives that play out over centuries in the United States with people. Mm-hmm. And so that is our new boogeyman, our immigrants that are seeking a better life that just so happen to be more brown and black. And you can see the distinction, I'll lastly say, when we look at asylum seekers that were coming from Ukraine recently and the fast track that they got versus people coming from Venezuela, Honduras. Okay, now let's talk about Florida and Florida and the rest. So we are not a monolith, right? Florida, Latino population is really diverse. A lot of times people identify based on the country they're from. You know, for me, it's interesting is people always like, what is the Latino message, right? And I'm sure you hear this about the African-American vote. You're like, what is the Black vote message? Never do we say, what is the white vote message, right? Because we divide it up by class, zip code, issues that those communities are facing. Are they men or women? What's their income? What are they going to be up against?
Middle class Ohio diner workers. That's always like the generic, like, but somehow a super subset category.
Yeah, but like they get subsets. We don't get subsets. We get like Black, Latino. And in a place like Florida, there's not like one Latino winning message. There's like five, right? And it's based on where people live, their income, and their national origin background, right? In a place
Puerto Rican.
Venezuelan, right? Republicans actually have invested in and understood that better, I think, than Democrats in Florida. And when you get to other places like Texas, where we're 85% of our 11.2 million Latinos are of Mexican descent, there's like two or three messages, but we're more monolithic than a place like Florida, but we're not.
Yeah.
But again, we have to have distinctions. And so that's where we get into trouble. It seems so obvious, right? You're not going to have just one Black or Latino message. And yet that continues cycle after cycle to be the ridiculous assumption that they make about our communities, that there's one winning message.
Yeah, we run into a very similar experience in the African-American community with, you know, are you Haitian? Are you Afro-Caribbean? Are you Brazilian? Are you Dominican? You know, there's so many subsets, but the overarching theme is, are you Black? Are you Christian? And it's like, well, even more so than ever, young African-Americans aren't connecting with churches, aren't connecting with religion. And I would imagine very much so in the Latino community that you're seeing this separation just from institutions in general.
Yeah.
And so as you were talking about with young communities in the Democratic Party, we don't feel tied to institutions in the same way. So we also don't feel the same blind loyalties in the same way. So whereas I think you're seeing Republicans have this enthusiasm for Donald Trump and for Republicans overall because they see this connection to Republicanism, whereas I'm not so sure that young Democrats see a connection to the Democratic Party in the same way.
Yeah, so young people don't, right? The statistics are pretty clear. When you ask young people, like, what's your party affiliation, you're going to get a pretty high percentage, depending on the poll. It could even be upwards like 40 to 45% will say unaffiliated, right? But when you look at how they're going to vote, nearly all of them are going to vote for Democrats because we live in a two-party system. Mm-hmm. I think my message in thinking for young people is, look, I've been a community organizer, labor organizer for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I think when I originally started out, I was a lot less willing to compromise because I didn't understand power, right? And now that I became an organizer, like, you have to build towards power. And we're in this moment where, again, like, when we look back at the Democratic Party, how far it's come, where we're talking about canceling student debt, billions and trillions of dollars of it, mm-hmm. where we're talking about putting legislation forward that the Biden-Harris administration put forward that is the largest single investment by any country on the planet to tackle the climate crisis, where we're talking about taking on the NRA, where the big one for me is we're talking about taxing the rich, their mm-hmm. fair share, and that working and middle-class people deserve to pay only their fair share, and that rich and the biggest corporations are not paying their fair share. Where we're talking about the president going and being on a picket line with United Auto Workers. Yeah. We've come a long way, and we've come a long way because voters have turned out for more progressive policy. And so I think, like, we have to keep going and marching. And when I look at what are the options for young people, look, Biden and Harris, because we had the largest youth voter turnout in 2020, they delivered on student debt as much as they could, given that the Supreme ultra right wing controlled didn't let us, that mm-hmm. they delivered as much as they could on gun safety reform, delivered on climate change, that we have the first progressive African American woman in the Supreme Court justice. Like, these are huge, huge wins that I honestly only believe happened because young people turned out in record numbers. And I know that young people still have a lot more we want to get done for the next generations. And so for me, it's like, which candidates and parties can I push the most? That's the calculus, not who's like absolutely perfectly aligned with me. You know, there's very few people that are perfectly aligned with me.
But what do you say to young Democrats who are disillusioned with Democrats who say, you know, the Nancy Pelosi wing of the party has gotten too old, it's too white, it doesn't look like me, we didn't go far enough with, you know, protecting abortion rights when we could, you know, yada, yada, yada. What do you say to them? Because if they stay home, that's ballgame.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's what they count on, is for us to be apathetic or disillusioned or not recognize our power. That's what I mean. Like, as an organizer, I organized 10 years undocumented workers that literally couldn't vote. Like, they didn't even have that political armor, power, or tool to use.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. And so for me, again, it's about the political calculus of who can I push. And I don't think we get to a place where Biden and Pelosi are talking about taxing the rich their fair share without young people turning out. Like, we have to, we very oftentimes on the left don't realize when we're winning, right? Mm-hmm. And the right, they'll keep going at it. They took them 50 years to overturn Roe.
Yep.
50 fucking years to overturn Roe.
And they did it. They stuck with it.
They stuck with it, and they took us back 50 years on basic fundamental rights to decide when I get to have a baby, yeah. when I get to choose to make a family, like what I get to do with my health. And so I think we have to realize, like, we've actually done a lot in a few years. You know, I voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016 during the primary. And then I turned around and voted for Hillary Clinton because my political calculus was like, who am I going to get done more with, Trump or Hillary Clinton? And the other thing I would say is, look, don't think about voting as the most important thing you do. In fact, I hate when politicians be like, this is the most important thing you can do.
I want to hear this. Let's dig deeper.
I just think about it as it's the most basic thing you must do, not the only thing you should do, right? Okay. And I'm not going to leave a powerful tool and weapon on the table for my opponent to use against me, right? Because when you leave your vote on the table, you're letting the Republican Party, you're letting Trump and his allies then turn around and use that tool and weapon against our communities. So again, like, it's not the only thing you do, but it's the most basic thing you must do.
Yeah. One of the most frustrating things, I was a public defender in Manhattan in a previous career.
God's work, Michael.
Yeah, it was amazing. But one of the most frustrating things I would see was, one, people who had the ability to vote and didn't vote, and the laws that were being put in place were specifically put in place to disenfranchise them and stopping them from voting. So watching in real time them being disenfranchised and partly not understanding, but also because of survival, not really having time to comprehend what was going around them, because all they're concerned with is, how am I going to keep my children alive? How am I going to keep my family safe? Like, I think a lot of times people want to be critical of people in lower economic positions for not exercising the right to vote, while also not acknowledging the systems in place around them that stop them from voting, whether it be the long lines that are in place, whether it be hourly wages, the transportation to get them to and from. I mean, like, if you live in rural Mississippi and you've got to get to a voting place and, you know, you're already running low on gas and you're trying to figure out, do I afford to go to work or do I go vote? That's easy calculus.
Yeah. I mean, and you brought up the long lines, right? Like, again, you know, my mom lives in Ohio. She lives in a lower income neighborhood. I remember in 2016, like, I was harassing her to go vote because she was like, well, Hillary's going to win anyway.
Yeah.
I was like, I was like, you need to go vote. I was pregnant at the time. And my son's father is a dreamer. So he came to the country and he was documented as 8 years old. Yeah. And I said, do you want to tell Santi that if Trump won, that you allow, like, my son's name is Santi, that, like, when this child is born, you want to be able to tell him that you didn't go vote against the person that wanted to rip his family apart and take his dad from him? You want to have that on your, like, legacy? That got her to vote.
That's the ultimate guilt trip. I love it.
Yeah. But then she went and voted, and she waited in line 3 hours, right? Because it was so long. And we sometimes, you know, we'll take video clips at campuses of really long lines, and people will be like, yeah, that's so great. But this is not great. No one should have to wait in line hours to enact their basic civic duty and vote. Like, no one, that those lines, and those lines do not exist in upper middle class white neighborhoods. No. They just do not exist.
No, and they're a system put in place to deter people from voting. They're completely solvable problems. It does not have to be like that. Anyone says it does is absolutely lying. You talked about dreamers. A lot of people don't really understand dreamers and only know about it from Fox News. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what it means to be a dreamer and how that system is in place?
Yeah. So I'll talk about a very personal perspective, right? So there are close to 11 million undocumented people in the United States. A lot of people came to this country or like a smaller number, but came with their parents when they were undocumented. Mm-hmm. Manuel, the father of my child, he came when he was 8 years old. He crossed the Rio Grande River with his mother. So just a couple weeks ago, when a mother was with her 8-year-old child and her other child and drowned in that river, was like, you know, I could feel it very deeply because that could have been my family. And so he came when he was 8 years old. He went to school in the United States. He learned English. He was like on every sports team. And he was able to go to college, even though the college counselor told him, you're undocumented, you'll never be able to go to college. And he was valedictorian of his high school. And he graduated and he was in college when there was no DREAM Act. There was no DACA. DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And young people under Obama, when we talk about young people organizing, young people started to organize and demand a pathway or some legal status because they'd grown up in this country. They didn't, literally some of them didn't even speak languages of their native countries anymore. This was the only place they knew. They had done everything right. And now they weren't going to be able to work or achieve their dreams. And so young people organized in 2012 when Obama was up for reelection. To be clear, the Democratic Party did not want to move forward on this as a whole. Mm-hmm. Obama didn't want to move on this as a whole. And young people started organizing and doing sit-ins in Obama's campaign offices, and they put so much pressure on him that he did DACA, and it ended up being a huge, very popular policy. And it's under threat today because they've tried to repeal it. And remember, Trump did try to do that, and they're going to continue to try and do that. Ultimately, the right-wing conspiracy theories, right, when they're attacking immigrants, and I think this is especially important for communities of color, in the African American community that may be a few, maybe many generations detached from the immigrant experience, is to understand it through a racial justice lens, right? We know that if you are Black and brown in this country, that some of the powers that be refuse to ever see us as full. citizen and don't want to. So I'm very clear that when they're attacking immigrants, that they're not just afraid of people like my 64-year-old Mexican immigrant mama, right? They're afraid of me, her U.S. citizen daughter that can vote and has a very different vision for my country than the one I see that they're offering, right? And so that's ultimately what they're trying to stop. And that's why they also talk about birthright citizenship and getting rid of it. It was fine for white folks, but they don't want it to exist for brown and black folks.
Yeah. And so now moving forward, we've hit this point where the Tucker Carlsons of the world, kind of these really right wing Charlie Kirk personalities, have basically started using this thing known as the replacement theory and talking about how Democrats are trying to bring in immigrants to replace white Americans, to replace the culture of America, and increase the likelihood that Democrats will be able to vote, because ergo immigrants somehow support Democrats. And so our
and
voting
also
roles.
They automatically get to vote when they get here, which is like not the case at all.
not the case at all. Talk to me about like why these theories are so crazy.
Well, I mean,
let me always say, I have to say this too. You are not the spokesman for all of these issues, just like I am not the spokesman for every black issue and every crime question. But I think personal experiences are really important.
Well, you have to remember that these same forces are also extremely anti-Semitic. So not only do they believe that, for example, when you had Central Americans organizing themselves as a caravan to try and make it to the United States because they literally don't have food to feed their children, or they're up against criminal gangs and networks that murder them, right? Like there is a real drug war in Mexico and in other places where people are, it literally cannot even operate legitimate businesses and are under threat. And so they believe that these forces, that people organizing themselves to come seek a better life, are actually controlled by the Jewish community. Like that's how insane these
and
are.
Like George Soros. And yeah, this George is Soros, just, yeah.
Yeah, this is, and I remember reading this theory and like had to listen to it two times. I was like, because I've worked with Latin American, I was like, wait, they think the Jewish community is organizing like across this is their way to stop a Christian majority in the United States, which is also interesting because most of these people are Christian. So these are their theories, right? And they're ultimately what they are afraid of is that the United States will not be a white majority country, because they always wanted it to be a white majority country where communities of color were more exploitable, less equal. And if you have more numbers, you have more power. And ultimately, we have to remember that that is what they don't want. They don't want us to be equal to them. And so this is their long-term plan to have white dominant control of this country. First, I think this country should be for everyone, and that everyone deserves these basic rights and these basic opportunities. And they're fundamentally trying to stop that.
At the front line of this is Governor Greg Abbott, the governor of your state, Texas. What the hell is he doing? Let's just be honest about it. Like, what the hell is he doing in Texas?
He is preparing to run for president. That is what he's doing. And he is using the lives of asylum seekers, refugees, migrants, the most poor and desperate people, some of the most poor and desperate people in the world, as his jumping off point, and using them as a political stunt. Everything that is happening in Texas is a political stunt to be able to run for president. Now, he wanted to run this go round, but he saw Trump didn't go out.
You really think Abbott's running for president?
Oh, 100% Abbott is running for president. And anytime someone is using their home state to run for president, they don't ultimately care about their home state. They care about their power.
Ron DeSantis is perfect proof of that.
Yeah. And he has spent billions of dollars of taxpayer money here in Texas to militarize the border, to militarize communities on the border. And what you have to remember about Texas is, so I'm half white, I'm half Mexican. My dad's white, my mom's Mexican. My white grandpa lived in Houston. He always wore a cowboy hat, fringe jacket, and boots. So I think when people think about Texas, they think about that image. But actually, our state is actually majority young, brown, and black. That is who Texas is today. So Latinos now make up the largest ethnic majority in Texas, over 40%. African-Americans are, we are the largest Black population of any state in the country. A lot of people don't know that as well about Texas. That's why we talked about making it the hardest place to vote in the country. They are very determined because if Republicans also know if they lose Texas,
It's game over.
And ultimately, when I think about like how we change the country, we have to be playing long-term games. Yeah, we need to short-term games and long-term. Yes, we need to be invested in the key battleground states. But in Texas, half of the people turn
18. Just real quick, Texas used to lose. Like Ann Richards used to be the Democratic governor of Texas. Now, that Democratic Party was a little different of a Democratic Party. But like Democrats didn't have a hold on Texas for a while. It's only in recently that the governorship has switched over to Republicans.
Yes, that's right. And they know the numbers, like they're terrified by the numbers. And so half of the people turning 18 are Latino in Texas. African-Americans, Latinos and Asians every year, 475,000 total in Texas. Sorry, African-Americans, Latinos, Asians, 270,000 turn 18 every single year. Bethel lost by 220,000 votes in 2018. So if you invest in young people of color, you start to dramatically alter the state. We are just not investing at the scale necessary. But ultimately, Greg Abbott is running for president. It's all a political stunt. We are home. 1 in 6 Texans are foreign born. I think we are the state that has been one of the greatest beneficiaries of immigration. Greg Abbott, if he wanted to actually have constructive solutions, would be using his position as governor with a huge foreign born population and getting a lot of contributions from the industry that's the largest employer of undocumented labor to call for immigration reform, to call for long-term solutions, but he has no interest in doing that because he wants to beat up on the poorest, most disenfranchised people with the least resources for his own political gain.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, I say immigration is a really hard thing to solve because I think there's a lot of factors in play, but that's like the political side of it. Greg Abbott, if he wanted to solve this, given the farming industry, given all of the industry and the economy scale of Texas, it seems like could work with the communities and the countries that either border Texas or bordering Mexico and or people are coming through to address this. And it really is just purely, it's easier for him to run on these issues than it is to solve them.
Yeah, I mean, like, we're talking about him putting up barbed wire at the border and having people stand there. Like, people are still coming.
Yeah.
That's not going to stop. What we have to have is a multi-pronged strategy where we recognize that there have been people in this country for 20, 30 years living in our communities, going to our schools, contributing, paying their taxes, that they deserve a fair shot at the American dream. The American dream, right? Like they deserve a fair shot. And then so there needs to be immigration reform for those folks. There needs to be investment in the root causes of migration. We never talk about how American policy has also destabilized many of these regions and led to people to migrate in the first place. And then you can talk about a smarter way to do asylum seeking at the border. You can talk to Mexico. You can actually have real ways to talk about it is okay to like have some border security, but do that in a way that actually makes sense. Like barbed wire is not going to stop people from coming to the United States. You're talking about people that crossed Mexico where they were literally, some people were killed, raped. They've walked hundreds of miles, some of them barefoot, to come to this country. You think they're going to stop because of barbed wire? Like that is the level of desperation that I don't think these legislators understand or care about.
Yeah, I was on air with Hogan Gidley, former Trump White House deputy press secretary, yesterday, and we were in the commercial break. We're talking about the immigration bill, and I asked him, Hogan, what do you think these people are going to do? They are coming from Central America, going all the way up through Mexico. They're getting there. They're declaring asylum. And you're saying you can't stay here while you're awaiting asylum. Mexico is saying we don't want to have all these people sitting on our border either. Like, we're America. Like, when you talk about the American dream, do you really mean the white dream, or do you mean the American dream? Like, which is it? And not to give, it's unfair to not say we ran out of commercial time, so Hogan wasn't able to solve the immigration debate in a commercial break. But I think it goes to a broader point that it is complicated. It's going to take multiple countries to solve this. But like, at the end of the day, this is all people. And it feels like Republicans have been better at messaging fear than Democrats have been at messaging hope when it comes to immigration.
And we placate often. I think there has to be a recognition also, like for me, when I was organizing construction workers, I remember I originally went to the unions, to the few unions that exist here in Texas that organize.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys, I think they busted all the unions at this point. Yeah,
in the construction industry. And I really learned a lot from them, right? Like, they taught me about how they really did feel like undocumented labor was hurting their ability to compete. And it's true, but I think that we can, but the undocumented workers weren't gaining anything from the system or the status quo. They didn't want the system the way it was. Mm-hmm. The industry and business was gaining from the status quo. I think that we can build a system that protects American workers, protects foreign-born workers, allows us to fulfill our labor needs. Like, we have huge labor gaps in this country, and that is in part because we have always, always had immigrants be part of our economic system and model to fulfill those labor needs. But people should be able to do that with basic rights and protection. And one example I'll give is, even if you look under Obama or Trump, the amount of money we spent on enforcement, right? People that say they support the rule of law. So much money goes into Homeland Security, right? If we wanted to protect American-born workers, I actually think we should take a huge chunk of that money and put into OSHA, the National Labor Relations Board that protects unionizing, protects public safety, sorry, health and safety at the workplace, more enforcement for wage and hour folks from the Department of Labor to investigate work sites and make sure that all workers are protected. Like, that's about the rule of law. Why aren't we doing that? Because we know.
You've run for office. You know why.
Yeah, I know.
No one can run on, let's increase funding.
Well, let's just take the funding we're using for failed policies that clearly aren't working at the border and put it in to enforcing labor rights that are also going to protect American-born workers, if that's what we really want to do.
Yeah. And the problem is, we live in a country where everybody's running for re-election all the time. And when they're always running for re-election, and when people want to stay in office forever, like, that's the other big thing. We got people that are making careers out of being in office. And it's kind of like, what's the incentive to get things done if you can exacerbate the problem and use it to run on?
Yeah. And I think that's part of like young people's frustration. I think for me, it's both and, right? Like, I think we want to be able to see fresh blood and fresh ideas. And at the same time, I always find it, to me, it's more about like it's often about the policies too, because young people voted overwhelmingly, because people will say, I don't want to vote for a career politician. And then they voted overwhelmingly for Bernie Sanders, who's been in elected office since for 4 decades. Like, but it's because he has progressive policies that are about disrupting the status quo and ultimately addressing people's economic pain that they feel and live every day.
So I'll admit it. I was very critical of Bernie Sanders in 2016, not because of his policies, but because of him being an independent and running as a Democrat, which I think a lot of us have now become a lot more comfortable with. And Bernie has pushed Democrats to the left in a way that I think has saved the Democratic Party.
Yes, 100%.
How do you think history is going to look back at Bernie Sanders in terms of the broader Democratic Party? You read a whole book on that, I know.
It's hard to...
Because people like me, we're just like, nope, not Bernie. And now we look at Bernie Sanders as someone who has really saved the party.
And I do think he did. I think not everyone sees it that way, but like, it's hard to overstate how much he has done in transforming the party and helping give them winning messages. If you look at Biden and all the Democrats that ran in 2020, many of their messages, their policies, ideas came from Bernie, right? Like, we are so, and they're not even that radical? Like, because here's the thing, right?
Well, then, yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, the public option, I mean, he managed to outflank things in a way that made moderate policies look progressive.
Yeah. And it's just, it was really about offering a different economic vision. And I think that that's the point. It was there was a lack of understanding and appreciation post the collapse in 2008 of just how deep and broad the economic pain was for the average American, right? Like you had at a certain point, like depending on the numbers, but like close to half of Americans not having more than $1,000 in savings, right? Like people literally were one emergency away from total economic collapse. The idea that minimum wage in this country, and it still is federally $7.25 an hour, right?
It's a poor.
Yeah. And Bernie came out and said $15 an hour, and people said that was crazy, right? He came out and talked about the labor movement and needing to protect labor unions. He talked about taxing the rich their fair share. There are so many, and he did it in very simple language that I think.
Imagine Democrats.
For me, look, what I say is, I don't think, and Bernie's been in it long enough. He knows he's not going to win all of those policies, but he was, I think the failure and kind of what folks got frustrated with Democrats as versus Republicans is Republicans were starting negotiating way over here, right? They would like demand everything they wanted, and Democrats were going into the negotiating room. What can we get Republicans to agree to right away? And like kind of start there. And then you immediately already are moving from a position, not of what we actually need, but what you think your opponents will agree to. Yeah. And Bernie got them to start negotiating at a different place and work their way backwards. And that's how we get the Inflation Reduction Act, the largest climate bill. That's how we get Biden canceling student debt, ultimately at first with $10,000 and all the Pell and folks with Pell Grant loans. And then the Supreme Court, of course, not allowing that to move forward. But then them figuring out all these other ways to still cancel billions of dollars of student debt for young people. And that's where I think we still have stuff to learn a little bit as big D Democratic Party and also younger generation is negotiation, like the best, how are we starting with what we deserve and then working our way back? And ultimately, we never let go of what we deserve, but we're going to take the win where we can.
Are you afraid that the conflict in Gaza is going to suppress or depress turnout among young Democrats? Because that's something that really scares me, especially in places like Michigan and Dearborn and places in Georgia where you have large Arab communities.
Yeah, I think there's any poll or data will show you that the majority of young people support a ceasefire, that there is a large generational divide within progressives and the Democratic Party with support or opposition to the Israeli government or support or opposition to the Palestinian cause. And so, you know, you have some polls showing that close to 70% of young people support a ceasefire in Gaza, and a lot of young folks very opposed to the way the Biden-Harris administration has moved on this issue. And I think like when we look overall at the policies, climate change, gay marriage, abortion rights, gun control, taxing the rich their fair share, unions, it's night and day between Republicans and Democrats. On this issue, young people are very passionate. And you know, our message has been to the administration, you need to listen to young people because they do care about this issue a lot. I think we still have yet to see how it will impact the election. For me, it's ultimately like, who can I push and move in the right direction? And there is a big general, this was the one area where we really hadn't had to do foreign policy since Bernie pushed his movement. And Bernie's also interesting because he also was not calling for a ceasefire. And so there's like a clear generational divide. And so for me, I encourage young people to keep organizing and pushing on this issue and understanding we vote on multiple issues and make that political calculation. Who will I vote for that I can push the most? Because let's be very clear, Trump and the Republican Party want the elimination of Palestine. And there are deep evangelical religious beliefs that believe that we cannot allow Palestinians to be in Jerusalem. Like these are long for the rapture and all kinds of things that they believe that they need to be controlled by the Jewish community. And so they are very, very clearly opposed to Palestinians even being in the lands where they've been for centuries.
And because I, you know, have been asking you nothing but layup questions here, clearly. As we close up, what's at risk in this election? I know that's kind of the generic question everyone asks, but like with Trump seemingly on the ballot, with abortion on the ballot in a lot of states, with democracy, truth, with all of these things on the ballot, it really seems like, and we say this in every election, but we're at a pivot point, that we're at an inflection point. But even more so now, especially after January 6th and what we saw in the wake of the last election, what is your message to voters, especially young voters, about what the risk is?
Well, I think it's both risk and what's the opportunity, right? I think for a lot of young people too, right? Some of them were teenagers that are just become voters, but maybe they were like 16 or 14 when Trump was president. They don't fully remember everything about the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. But I think in 2016, there were a lot of people like, oh, give Trump a chance. He just said those things while he was running. He's not actually going to do all of those things, right? And then he immediately came into office, enacted a Muslim ban, pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accord, called Nazis in Charlottesville very nice people, right? Supported white supremacist ideas in our immigration system, cut taxes for the ultra rich and wealthy, made very clear that everything he had said, he was actually going to try and deliver on. Trump 2.0 does not get any better. It gets more. He is looking at long-term control of our country for the ultra wealthy, for people that are of his his status, right? Like, and ultimately, nowhere in the narrative do I hear very much space for people that look like you and me in the future that they are trying to build for this country. Like, they are determined to create a second class citizenship status for us long term. And when we think about, look what they did, like Trump took power. He put in the most conservative Supreme Court justices in American history, and immediately we got the reversal on Roe. So everything he's going to do on immigration, on going after his political opponents, setting up an economy that's just going to work for the top 1%, are all things I promise. I predict he would deliver on. On the other side is what we can win. You know, when I think about the inflection point we're at, I also think about the climate crisis. Like, we don't have time. And these folks want to expand drilling to keep our economy on fossil fuels, even though it's literally global suicide to do that. So we have to do everything in our power to keep them out of power. And don't believe in the bullshit and cynicism that they want us to feel. Cynicism is the enemy, right? And I don't care if you, like, there is no candidate there's very few candidates that have ever been like, hell yes, I'll go to the ends of the earth for you. I go to the ends of the earth for my community. I go to the ends of the earth for the people that I live with, the people that I say work hard. And my political calculation is who will best deliver for me and who can I best push. And again, the last thing I'll say at NextGen, we don't put our hope in any political party or politician. We put our hope in America's young people to exercise their power and move the party and the politicians in the right direction.
Christina Sinsoon Ramirez, NextGen, thank you so much. I literally could talk to you for hours upon hours upon hours.
Another day.
Yeah, so we're going to have to do this again. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for talking, giving our audience a little insight to what's going on. And we will absolutely have you back. And that's a wrap on another episode of Political Roots. A big thanks to Christina for joining the show. Be sure to check her out on Instagram and Twitter at Christina NextGen. That's CRISTINA NextGen. I refuse to say X, so, you know. Engage with her, be kind to her, and become part of the incredible work that she's leading over at NextGen. Lastly, don't forget to subscribe to Political Roots for more conversations with some of the most interesting and influential people in politics. I'm Michael Starr Hopkins, and until next time, keep your roots deep and your beliefs strong. Take care.